63. They came for her just after midnight, knocking as if to wake her, but she hadn't slept a wink. The whole hut dark and chill, her guardians hushed and nervous. "This is when the climbers always leave," Prisca told her reassuringly, "to get up high before sunlight starts the rockfall." Prisca and Sibylla took her into one of the washrooms and ran a wand over her body as she stood shivering in her underwear. Then the wand all over the clothes she was to wear, everything she was going to take along, which was hardly anything. They had asked her to leave her phone at the hut. It would be conveyed to her later on, same with her clothes. They thought she was clear of tracking devices, they said, but it was best to be sure and leave behind everything not needed for this day. The hut keepers outfitted her with warm clothing, with climbing boots and crampons, and an outerwear suit like a pair of overalls, but lined with down. A kind of space suit, it seemed to her. Also a climber's helmet and a harness to wear around her waist and thighs. "I don't think I like this plan," Mary said. "It will be all right," Prisca said. "The Frunden Josh is not that hard." "I don't like the sound of that," Mary said. She knew that "not that hard" when talking about the Alps was Swiss speak for fucking hard. And she knew that Josh meant pass, meaning probably the low point at the head of their basin, up there above the glacier that had visited the day before. There had been a notch up there in the cliff over the ice, the cliff which was a walled-off section of the crest of the great Berner Oberland. Once you knew to look for it, the notch was visible even from the hut. But the day before, she had seen that the black rock below the notch had looked completely vertical. "Not that hard, right?" At 2 a.m. they went out into the frigid night. There was no moon, but illuminated by stars, the basin walls glowed as if with the black interior light of their own. Their headlamps speared the night and illuminated variable circles and ellipses of rough stone ground ahead of them. Mary was roped between Thomas and Prisca, with Sibylla and Jörg on another line beside them. They all had headlamps on their climbing helmets, so no one looked at each other as they spoke. After a couple of hours of walking up the stony slope, Mary huffing and puffing and warming up throughout her body, all except for her nose, ears, toes and fingertips, they came to the foot of the glacier remnant. After that, they scrambled up the left lateral moraine, which was composed of loose boulders held poorly in ice-crusted sand. Then Mary had to focus on getting up onto the ice side of the glacier itself. The slope of white ice they were proposing to ascend was tilted at about 45 degrees, maybe more. It was therefore crampon work, a hard little climb. She had never done anything like it. They sat her down and helped her strap the crampons into her boots and handed her an ice axe, and after that, when she kicked the ice off the glacier, the front points of her crampons bit into it very nicely. With a good kick, it became like standing on the step of a ladder, a step which was really just her stiff-bottomed boot stuck in place. Rather amazing. Up the side of the glacier she went, kick, kick, kick. With the rope extending up from her to Thomas, who was already up on the flatter top of the glacier, it was almost simple. Then she was walking on the glacier's top with the rest of them and feeling her crampons' downward pointing points stick into the ice surface with every step. Sometimes she sank a bit and then stuck, piercing a layer of hard snow. That was fern, Prisca told her, good to walk on. In fact, it was quite strange. Mary found she preferred the bare ice, where she stuck instantly with each step, remaining almost a full crampon tooth's height above it. She had to free her feet with little jerks at each step, then step a little high when moving her feet forward, or she would catch a spike and trip. After she stepped and stuck, she couldn't have slid her foot even if she wanted to. That was reassuring. The boots they had equipped her with were a little too large for her feet, she thought. Sliding around inside the boots was the only give in the whole process. None of this was comfortable for her. It wasn't her kind of thing. She wondered if the whole adventure was even necessary, but didn't want to ask about that, as it would sound like a criticism. If she was in danger, they were in danger. And yet, of course, they were sticking with her. It was their job. So she did what they told her to without any commentary of that sort. The fact they thought this was necessary was quite frightening, actually, if she allowed herself to think about it, which she didn't. She focused on the ice underfoot and her breathing. They crunched up the high glacier at a steady pace. The creak and scritch of their crampon straps and points were the only sounds. Once they heard the clatter of a rock falling. Other than that, windless silence. Black sky filled with stars. Milky Way almost setting in the west like a noctilucent cloud. Thomas was following a series of flags that flew from wooden sticks, set into cans filled to the top with cement. Mary shuddered to think of carrying the cans up here. They had to weigh 20 kilos at least, but now they stayed put and guided the way up to the pass. Priska said they were threading some crevice fields. They would move the flags when the glacier's ice moved, she said, although that wasn't such a problem on this one, which had melted up to a kind of minimum remnant, an almost stationary ice field. Priska and Sibylla tried to point out some crevices to her as they passed them, but Mary couldn't see them. Slight depressions in the snow blanketing the ice. Maybe fern rather than ice, she would have walked right over them. A bad idea. Walking by one of the flags, she saw by her headlamp glare that both cans and flags were painted orange. By starlight, they were grey. After 2 hours of this ascent, they came to the top of the glacier and faced the black rock of the pass. There was a short and steep-sided gap between the ice of the glacier and the black rock. This gap was the Bergschrund, they told her. Famous for presenting a problem in getting from glaciers onto headwalls, sometimes a terrible problem. Happily, this Bergschrund had a staircase of sorts hacked into the eyesight under their feet, its shallow, irregular steps much punctured by crampon tips, leading down to the black rock and ice blocks junking up the bottom of the dark little ravine. Tricky work. Once they got down there, Priska and Thomas actually took her by the hands and watched her footwork with her. And she took their support gratefully. I'm 58 years old, she wanted to tell them. This isn't my kind of thing. I'm a city girl. From the bottom of the slash, it was eerie to look up and see just a narrow band of stars overhead. On the rock side of the Bergschrund, they climbed by spiking their crampon tips into cracks in the rock. This seemed like a bad idea, but in fact her boots stuck on the rock even more firmly than they had in the ice, and the rock wall proved to have setbacks in it, almost regular enough as to have been cut by and for people, though Priska said they weren't. Then they topped the wall and were hiking scratchily, as if on tiny stilts, over almost flat slabs of black rock, leading them slightly up between vertical black walls to each side of them. It looked like a roofless hallway, carved by titans. Priska, in full tour guide mode, despite or because of the surreal weirdness of it all, told her that joint faults in the rock had allowed the glacier, when it had been so high as to cover this entire section of the ridge, to pluck and shift loose blocks out of this passage, pushing them probably to the south, as they would see shortly. Now the missing fault block made a break in the ridge, the notch they had seen from below as squared off as if drawn by a plumb line and carpenter's level. Very surreal. Not to mention the thought of an icy so high that it had covered this part of the range, and presumably all the rest of the Alps, all except for even higher ridges and peaks. Just another Swiss Alpine pass, Thomas and the others seemed to suggest by their attitudes, but Prisca was obviously proud of it. Each pass in the Alps had its own character, she said. Most were well known since the Middle Ages, or perhaps long before, back to the time when people had first come to these mountains thousands of years ago. Like the Iceman, found emerging from a glacier in a pass to the east of here. He had crossed his pass 5,000 years before, or failed to cross, Mary thought but did not say. So they walked through the notch of the Flundinjosh. It was like passing through a hallway from one world to another. It only took about 5 minutes. They were just 13 metres short of a 3,000-metre pass, Prisca said. People often jumped up to pretend to touch that 3,000-metre height above the oceans. Swiss people, Mary thought. She couldn't have jumped an inch off the ground. When they came to the far end of the notch, dawn was flooding the Alps to the south, the raw yellow of morning, a new world indeed. Alpenglow stained east-facing peaks pink. Slopes facing the other points of the compass were mauve or purple or black. The ice below them was a rich, creamy blue, the sky overhead a clear, pale grey, tinged by the yellow light in the air. Peaks extended to the horizon in all directions, and to the south another great range paralleled the one they were crossing. Below them, a long, sinuous glacier was flanked by black lateral moraines. The Kanderfirn, Prisca told her, not bare ice, but fern, which gave it its velvety look, a dark turquoise velvet, very strange to see. Directly below them lay a drop of empty air, then a slightly tilted mass of bare ice, which served as a kind of terrace, making a long run down to the fern much farther below. The last drop at the end of the ice terrace to the fern was invisible to them from their angle, indicating something obviously steep, a cliff. Mary gritted her teeth as she looked down at it. It was a long way down, and she was already tired, her calves and Achilles tendons aching, an exhausted feeling in her muscles everywhere. She said nothing. She followed them step by step. Down, then down again. They helped her in places. Hiking on rock in crampons was awkward as hell, but it was solid too, in that her boots kept sticking in place. Not the worst sensation to have, given what a slip might do. Prisca confirmed what she felt in her feet. You could spike right into a crack on purpose and hold firm in a way that bare boots wouldn't have. That meant the pressure on her ankles was tremendous, and often she found herself right at the edge of her strength, right on the brink of a fall. Feet tilted this way and that in ways she never would have chosen. A couple of times, her only recourse was to give way and step down another step, too fast, unconsidered, desperate. Every time that happened, her feet stuck in some new crack, an unexpected salvation. Fuck, she said, time after time. Fucking hell! It couldn't last like that. Some step was bound to go wrong. Her heart was pounding. She was sweating. Nothing else existed but this steep, broken staircase of cracked black rock. After an endless spell of this work, they got to the ice terrace she had seen from the pass above, which now sloped down as far as they could see, then ended in mid-air. Obviously some kind of cliff out of sight down there, ice or rock, it didn't matter. It was going to be bad, wickedly bad. We wait here, Prisca told her. We wait, Mary repeated. For what? Prisca said, they are coming here for us. We're going to catch a ride. Thank God, Mary said. Far, far below, where they could see a different glacier surface, on the far side of the fern, she spotted a teeny line of flags. Now there was enough light to see they were orange. After 15 or 20 minutes, they heard a thwacking from down the valley. Up to them rose a helicopter with the Swiss white cross on red painted on its side. It took a while to get up to them. It really was a long way down. And the air was thin. She could feel that right in her bones, a weakness she didn't like to feel. The helicopter landed loudly with a great rushing of air, some 50 metres away on an almost flat stretch of ice. With its rotors still blurring over it in a roar, a helmeted and flighted suited person opened a door in its side and got down and gestured them over to the craft. They ducked and crampled over to the helo, sat down in the ice and unstrapped their crampons. The others unhooked Mary's for her, then climbed up metal steps into the cabin of the thing. Here it was just as loud as outside, but after they sat down in the big central chamber and were strapped into their webbing seats by a crew member and got their climbing helmets off, they were given earmuff headsets. With those on, the world became very much quieter, and there were voices in her ears. The discussion over the headset was in Swiss German, so Mary just relaxed and flexed her calves and feet. Right on the verge of cramping they were in several different places. Thighs too. She was thrashed and no denying it. They had put her next to a little window, and as the helicopter rose she looked out. Steep black mountains, vast swathes of white snow. Then out over an even deeper valley, immensely bigger, mostly green-walled and floored by a river and freeways, train tracks, miniature villages with church steeples and square towers and rooftops, and vineyards rising in rows conjuring the sides of the great valley walls, especially the south-facing side to their right. The Rhone River, Mary assumed. If she was right, this was the Valais, one of the biggest valleys in Switzerland. Down this immense canyon they flew, lower than the mountains to left and right. Then they turned left, southward, and flew up a narrow valley. Mary knew that a Matterhorn stood at the top of one of these southerly valleys, but she couldn't imagine they would go to Zermatt to hide, and it seemed to her they had flown farther west than that anyway. In the brilliant horizontal morning light, these side valleys were still dark in shadow. She lost her sense of where they were. Eventually, the narrow canyon they were ascending closed on them, and the helicopter descended onto a concrete pad underneath a concrete dam, a dam very tall and very narrow, incurved like dams often were. A surreal sight, a comic book dam it seemed, exaggerated to caricature. They got out of the helo, went into a building by the landing pad. Here they sat and ate a quick meal, went to the bathroom, changed out of the snow boots and into more conventional hiking boots. "Not done walking yet," Priska explained. "Another short walk." "How short?" Mary said, annoyed and fearful. She was tapped out. She could feel that in her legs. 6 kilometres, Priska said. "Not that far." "And 200 metres up," Thomas added, as if correcting Priska. "Full disclosure kind of thing." Mary bit her tongue and said nothing. She was wasted. This was going to be bad. They left the building. By now it was late morning. The sun stood just over the top of the dam hanging over them. It was the tallest dam in Switzerland, they told her, the 5th tallest on earth, nearly 300 metres tall. Happily, a cable car was strung up the slope to the west of the dam. They got in a car and rose swiftly, getting an excellent view of the concrete incurve of the dam. Ear-poppingly tall. Hard to imagine someone saying, "Let's put up a dam here. Let's fill the air of this deep, narrow valley with a concrete wall 1,000 feet high." At the upper station of the cable car, they got out and walked through a long tunnel. a tunnel with open gallery sections on its left side that gave views down onto the reservoir behind the dam. Water the colour of radiator antifreeze. Then they were out of the tunnel and in a high, shallow valley headed west. Another narrow glacial valley with a trail that ran up its floor next to a chuckling brook. Mary tramped up this trail wearily. It was a lot easier than hiking in crampons and snow boots, she had to admit, but she was out of gas. Knackered! It was a little embarrassing that her guards didn't even seem to register it as effortful. Fucking Swiss and their fucking mountains. She had been out-skied by three-year-olds who weren't even using ski poles, zipping by her, not even seeing her. Why should she be surprised now they were like the ibexes up here? Home ground. Rocky, dusty trail. Green, grassy slopes bordering the creek bed. Rocky walls above the grass, high on the left, low on the right. Up and up and up again. Grinding. She felt weak in her bones. Then she noticed that the creek to her right was a dark brown colour. Its clear water riffled quickly over a reddish-brown stream bed. She looked closer. The creek was floored almost entirely by rusty nails. Nails, bolts, washers, nuts, L-joints, other bits of small metal hardware, all of it a dark, rich, rusty brown, carpeting the creek bottom in a dense tangle, like mussels or sea urchins. It was like a vision in a dream, surreal such that she could scarce believe her eyes. She actually wondered if in her exhaustion she was seeing things. What the hell's that? She asked her minders, pointing. They shrugged. From the old days, Prisca said. What old days? You will see. Then they topped a rise and found themselves in a round high basin, a mountain wall to their left, green alp to their right. Grass covered the floor of the basin, along with rocks of all size from small to house-sized, the big ones like dolmens in Ireland. And then she saw that some of these really were buildings, black-walled cubes of concrete, doorless and featureless. Then, as she looked around again, Mary saw that the cliff that walled off the basin to the south had inlaid into it three massive concrete doors, giant ovals perhaps 15 or 20 metres high and almost as wide. Like the blockhouses on the basin floor, these walls in the cliff were as blank as concrete could be. What is this? Mary asked. Military, Sibelia told her curtly. Air Force. Prisca added, gesturing at the giant doors in the cliff as if that explained what she meant. Civilians not actually allowed in this basin, they told her. No one comes here. But we did, Mary said. And then a small concrete door under the giant ones, so small Mary had not noticed it, opened from the inside. Her minders led her up and into it. She followed them right into the mountain. One of the Swiss Air Force's secret bases, she gathered. Prisca had gone uncharacteristically silent. Mary had heard rumours about these places. Everyone had. A rocket launch jet facility, remnant of the Cold War, designed to repel Soviet invasion. If the Soviet tanks had rolled, these big doors in the mountainside would have opened and Swiss jets would have shot out like bolts from Wilhelm Tell's crossbow. Swiss defence craziness. It wouldn't be the first time. And in fact, the jets were still there, racked on their launch slides, little things like cruise missiles with stubby wings and bubble cockpits, obviously outdated and old-fashioned, like weapons from the set of a James Bond movie. New cruise missiles made these things look like rowboats in a marina, like shillelaghs in a museum. It was a newer kind of warfare, she thought wearily, that had gotten her invited into this hidden fortress. They weren't just protecting her now, she guessed, nor her ministry. It was Switzerland itself under attack. This she gathered from the people there to greet her. The assault on the ministry had been part of a large attack, one of them confirmed to her. Viruses had sabotaged not just the ministry's computers, but other UN agencies based in Switzerland, and more importantly, their banks. So it was an emergency. They were on a war footing now. But for this new kind of war, invisible and online for the most part, but also including the possibility of drones and of fast targeted missiles. So now defending her ministry was part of defending Switzerland. And as this museum fortress served to show, the Swiss were very intent to defend themselves. Small country in a big world, as was explained to her by a Swiss military man as he escorted her along a big tunnel to a conference room deeper inside the mountain. Unusual things became necessary. He introduced himself. Turned out he was the country's defence minister. She sat down at a long table, suppressing a groan of relief, and was joined by a circle of officials. Such a relief to sit down. Her legs were throbbing. She glanced around the room. It was broad and low-ceilinged, its long black wall made of the green-black gneiss of the mountain itself, cut and polished like an immense facet of semi-precious stone. Overhead, a ceiling that seemed to be white ceramic glowed everywhere with a powerful diffused luminosity. Mary felt her face burning, knew by that feeling that she was sunburnt and trail-dusted, wiped out. Alpenverbraucht, Priska had called it. Alp-wasted. She looked around, saw that everyone at the table recognised how she felt and knew the feeling well. They had been there. They understood her state. One of them shuffled his papers, glanced at his phone, waiting for something. Then seven people walked into the room together. The Executive Council, Mary understood suddenly. All seven of their presidents. The seven-headed president of Switzerland sat down across the table from her. Five women, two men. She didn't know their names. They spoke English. Of course, this was for her sake, but a question distracted her as she tried to attend to them. She wondered what language they would speak if they were just among themselves. She dismissed the thought and tried to concentrate on what they were saying. Too exhausted to reply. Almost to understand. Some were French speakers and some German, she thought. Although with the Swiss it wasn't as easy to tell which was which as it would have been with actual French and Germans. And especially not now. It felt like she was reeling in her seat. One of the presidential women told her that they had come here to meet her because they were now confronted with a crisis that seemed to have something to do with her. The recent attack on her ministry was part of a larger attack, also under assault were the UN offices in the country, Interpol, the World Bank offices in Geneva, and Switzerland itself. The international order, in effect, was now under attack. Attack by whom? Mary asked. A long pause as the seven presidents looked at each other. We don't know, admitted one of the women. Swiss Romande. Marie Langlois, it came to Mary, a credit Swiss veteran. She went on. There's been an attack on our banking regulators that appears to have come from the same source as the attack on the Ministry for the Future. I see, Mary said, though she didn't. Did your ministry plan the hostage-taking of Davos? Langlois asked. Don't know. Mary said sharply. Then she added, but maybe those people had it coming, right? Did anyone really regret that? We did, one of the others said. Unfriendly silence. Mary let it stretch out. Their move, she felt, although none of them seemed to agree. What did they do to your banks? she asked at last. They looked around at each other. We are not bankers, Langua said, though she was. So we can't go into the details, but the attack apparently compromised many secret Swiss bank accounts. Revealed them? Mary asked. No. Private accounts are encrypted in multiple ways. They could not be revealed. But now the banks themselves are having trouble accessing files that decode owner's ID in order to contact them and so on. So the danger is not so much exposure of clients as loss of fundamental information. Mary said, "Your banks can't figure out who owns that." Somewhat the case, one of the others admitted. Another banker, Mary thought. Out of 7 Swiss presidents, how many came from a banking background? 4? 5? Of course it would eventually get sorted out, one of the presidents said. Information all on paper and in cloud, as of course it should be. Time machine storage. It took Mary a second to understand this meant a computer backup. But still, in the immediate aftermath of the attack, there was depositor fear, even panic, not good for stability. Mary nodded, silence as they watched her. She saw they were here to listen to her. She began to talk to them, almost as if thinking aloud to herself. Why not? She was too tired to find and apply her usual filters. It's the mystery of money, she said. Numbers that people trust, unlikely from the get-go. But then, if that trust was lost, boom, it was gone. Meanwhile, they were all part of a global financial system that had become so complex that even the people running it didn't understand it. She looked around at them as she said this. Yes, she meant them. An accidental megastructure, she went on, enjoying the sound of J.A.'s phrase, right to the heart of society. Right in this secret Swiss mountain fortress, which ultimately protects not just your countryside and your society, but your banks. Which means also people's trust in civilization. Their faith in a system that no one really understands. The 7 parts of the presidency regarded her. Mary felt a fog pass through her. Then she came to, it seemed, and became aware of them again. What do you want from this situation? She asked curiously. They wanted the Ministry for the Future defended, they told her. Even strengthened, just as part of Switzerland's own defence. They wanted better ways to make a better future, as part of making a safer Switzerland. It wasn't as if the country's 8 million people could live off what could be manufactured and grown in Switzerland alone. Country half the size of Ireland to start with, and 65% of that mountains useless to humans. The remaining 35% an agglomeration, satisfying human needs as best they could. They did what they could, but were part of a larger world, not self-sufficient. Self-sufficiency was a dream, a fantasy, sometimes of xenophobic nationalists, other times just a decent wish to be safer. Swiss people, mostly realistic, which meant being honest about what is possible, thus engagement with the world. So they wanted her ministry to succeed because they wanted Switzerland to succeed, which meant the world had to succeed. The future had to succeed. That would take planning. It would have to be engineered. All of this is well enough, Mary told them. It's our project too. But you can do more than you are. Right now you're not doing enough. She almost laughed as she heard herself doing a version of what Frank had done to her that night. But not a good idea to laugh at them for no obvious reason. And she suppressed it, recalling suddenly that vivid night, the way she had been transfixed by Frank's scorn, what had made his accusations so compelling. Because here they were not so convinced, she could see that. They thought they were doing all they could, as had she before Frank caught her. She asked if their banks really knew who their depositors were, even when their records were not damaged. They looked puzzled at this. "I ask," Mary said, getting irritated. Frank had been more than irritated. "Because your banks are often regarded as tax havens because of their secret accounts. Other countries lose tax money, which gets put in secret accounts here. So you're rich in part because you're the bagman for criminals worldwide, a kind of organised theft. People are supposed to trust money, but then a lot of it gets stolen by the very structure of money itself." Very unfriendly silence at this. Mary saw that and pressed harder. She might even have stood up if she could have mustered the energy. She might have shouted. "It was time for redemption for Switzerland," she told them flatly, keeping right inside the line of civility, or maybe on the edge of it. "All that stuff you want to forget as it never happened. The Nazi gold, the Jewish gold, the tax havens for oligarchs and kleptocrats, the secret bank accounts for criminals of all kinds. It's time to end all that. End the secrecy in your banks. Blockchain all your money and put all your ill-gotten gains to good use. Leverage it for good. Forge an alliance with all the other small prosperous countries that can't save the world by themselves. All of you rich little countries join together and then join up with India. Follow India's lead. Create more carbon coins by way of investments in carbon drawdown. That's the safest currency there is now. Far safer than the Swiss franc, for instance. Stabler. More stable. Your best choice at this point." Some of them were shaking their heads at this. "You need to join the world," Mary insisted. "You've always been Switzerland alone, the neutral one." "We join the Paris Agreement," one of them objected. "And Interpol," said another. "And the United Nations," said a third. "We've always been engaged," another clarified. "Okay," Mary conceded. "But now, join the carbon coin. Gather the rich small nations into a working group. Help get us to the next world system. New metrics, new kinds of value creation. Make the next political economy. Invent post-capitalism. The world needs it. It really has to happen. And you've got to change your banks now anyway, to recover from this attack. So change them for the good. Make them better." Silence. Mary looked at them. Up wasted. Yes, indeed. A feeling everyone in the room had felt. Descend back into the world after an ascent to that higher realm one encountered in the Alps. An encounter with the sublime, otherworldly, visionary. Then afterward, exhausted. Sunblasted, clarified. Transparent to the world, lofted into a higher realm. Mary knew she had an intense look she could fix on people. Her laser, Martin had called it. She had known it all her life, even in childhood when she had been able to freeze people in place, even her mother. Now she levelled it on these people facing her, and they too went still. Something had set her off, her exploded office, her cramping legs, the Alps. She lasered them. The Swiss presidents shivered collectively, shaking her off. They looked around the table at each other, not happy, not angry, not panicked, not dismissive. They were thinking.